Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you once again for coming to our latest event for celebrating the Religion Department's 50th anniversary. We have a number of talks throughout the whole year. And before I introduce our current speaker, I'd like to remind you that the next talk that we have coming up is December 2nd. That's a Wednesday. It will be in this same room at 2 o'clock by Ronald Green. You can get a... I'm sorry. 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock. I meant 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock in this very room on a Wednesday, December 2nd. That's the two, right? Okay. And you can get more details about that by looking on the departmental website. So today, it's my honor and pleasure to introduce Anne Monius. Anne Monius received her BA, MA, and PhD at Harvard through the Committee on the Study of Religion. And then she spent a short stint at the University of Virginia, where she was assistant professor in the Department of Religious Studies. And then she went back to Harvard, where she's been for about the last 13 years, and where she is professor of South Asian religions at Harvard Divinity School. And the work that she has done focuses on pre-modern South India, in the area that we could call the Tamil-speaking area of the South. And it deals with a religious landscape in which people are engaged in religious practices and discourse that nowadays would go by the names of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism. And her work encompasses all of these traditions. Her first book was called Imagining a Place for Buddhism, Literary Culture and Religious Community in Tamil-Speaking South India. She also has done a translation of Kamban's Iramavataram, which is the Tamil version of the Ramayana. She has translated War, Book 2 of that, which is just about to come out. And she also has Under Preparation, which is almost finished, Seeing the Lives of Shiva's Saints, History, Aesthetics, and Religious Identity in Tamil-Speaking South India. And as we found out this afternoon, she's also writing a book on Bob Marley. And so she is a person who has very diverse interests and who is also not afraid to jump in to a completely different area of study. And today she's going to be speaking on a topic that I think should be of interest to all of us, in particular, the students that are in the grad intro course. We have just read, a few weeks ago, we read Edward Said's Orientalism, and so that should be of particular interest to them, as well as, I think, to the rest of you. And the title of her talk is From Confidence to Critical Rethinking, The Study of South Asian Religions in the Wake of Said's Orientalism. So help me welcome Anne Monius.
The water's going to fall down here. Down there. Thank you, Kathleen, for that very kind introduction. I was thinking that I could perhaps keep my interest in Bob Marley secret for a while, but clearly it's out now. I'd like to begin formally by thanking John Kelsey and the entire department for inviting me to speak on what is truly an auspicious occasion, your program's 50th anniversary at Florida State. It's a real honor to be here. It's a pleasure to enjoy weather like this in November if you live in Massachusetts. But I must admit that I found preparing my remarks for you today quite troubling in multiple ways. Your department was established uncomfortably close to the date of my own arrival in the world. There's no denying middle age for either of us, alas. In reflecting upon how my particular subfield of South Asian religions, primarily Hinduism lately, has changed over the past 5 decades, I quite naturally found myself relating developments in my field to those far more quotidian markers in my own life, and it often wasn't pretty. So when I threw rocks at Tony Lenda in Mrs. Corey's kindergarten class, this is what scholars in my field were saying about Hindu ritual? Or when my big brother Peter slammed into me with his tricycle and sent me to the ER for 15 stitches, Robert Redfield's great tradition, little tradition, still held sway. And so it went. It was kind of a review of my own life in its very quotidian ways to the field. Needless to say, the study of South Asian religions was in a very, very different place 50 years ago when your Department of Religion was founded, both here in the United States and around the world. Indeed, it seems to us now, in many ways, a foreign land, one whose seeming political and cultural insensitivities might often make us cringe. David Mandelbaum, for example, the renowned American anthropologist who taught at the University of California, Berkeley, for more than 30 years, began his introduction to a 1964 issue of the Journal of Asian Studies devoted to what he called process and structure in South Asian religions with the following, quote, "The studies in this volume explore some of the main aspects of Hinduism in India and Buddhism in Ceylon." Now, we can't fault him for that. Ceylon wouldn't become Sri Lanka until 1972. "Because each article is based on the author's field observations, it deals with the realities of religion, as well as with its ideology, with its actual religious behavior, no less than with its hopes and beliefs. The emphasis here is on structure and process, more than on description and content," end quote. Perhaps most striking to those of us today who work in South Asian religions are these monolithic isms, Hinduism and Buddhism, that pass without comment, representing an unproblematized religion, no less a process and structure in the singular. Religion here consists of ideology glossed as its hopes and beliefs, while practice or religious behavior represents what he calls the realities of religion. So foreign now are process and structure in the study of South Asian religions that I actually had to keep reading to figure out exactly what he meant by the terms. Even more striking in the mid-1960s was the view from Indian scholars trained in South Asia and working and writing from South Asia. Sunanda Patwardhan, for example, who's best known for her work among Dalit, formerly called Untouchable, communities in Maharashtra, began a 1967 article with the following, quote, "Hinduism is the religion followed by the majority of people in India. It is all things to all people. It has many categories ranging from primitive animism to orthodox Vedic monism. Primitive religions form the lowest category and are slightly outside the pale of Hinduism." Nary a single word of this could stand academic scrutiny or sense of propriety today, from Hinduism as the religion of India to the pejorative labels of lowest and primitive. That elite Brahminic religion might be characterized as simply orthodox, Vedic, or monistic is also a thing of the past. Perhaps the most celebrated and widely influential book on Indian society and religion to emerge from the 1960s was the French sociologist Louis de Mon's detailed study of the caste system, Homo Hierarchicus, in contrast to what he calls in the book Euro-American Homo Equalis. 2 decades after de Mon's magnum opus first appeared in French, then University of Pennsylvania anthropologist Arjun Upadhyay described the work as, quote, "an elegy and a deeply Western trope for a whole way of thinking about India in which it represents the extremes of the human capability to fetishize inequality," end quote. 50 years later, there are no more isms in the study of South Asian religions. Everything has either become plural, religions, religious communities, or adjectival, Hindu community, Buddhist practice, even better, Sri Vaishnava communities, or Southeast Asian Sri Lankan Theravada Buddhist practices, and very, very few ever dare generalize beyond the immediate sources of their particular study. The edited volume, with its variety of scholars working across languages, regions, communities, disciplines, and time periods, seems the only safe way to say anything, or to be brutally honest, even vaguely imply anything, about South Asian religions writ large. When I was finishing up my doctoral work in the late 1990s, one of my advisors, Charlie Halsey, took rare pity on me for being unable to use terms like Buddhism that he himself had scattered with wild abandon throughout his dissertation just 15 years earlier without a second thought, and that at the University of Chicago, no less. Charlie said to me, and I quote him here verbatim because it's forever emblazoned in my mind, quote, even 15 pages of single-spaced caveats won't be able to save you on that one, Anne, end quote. And Buddhism, of course, appears nowhere in my dissertation as a result. What happened in between Dumont's confident assertion of civilization, fundamental human and civilizational difference in 1966, and my struggles to find an apt title for my dissertation 30 years later, was, of course, the publication of Edward Said's Orientalism in 1978. Said's work, as in brief, and as I'm sure you all know, particularly those of you in the first year grad seminar, essentially argues that Euro-American scholarship about Asia was and remains inextricably intertwined with colonial projects, making all such scholarship inherently political, subservient to power, and intellectually suspect. Although Said focused his attention on the Anglo-French construction of what we today call the Middle East, few scholars felt the Said sting so acutely as those working in South Asia, where knowledge construction and the demands of commerce and political rule had blatantly and institutionally developed hand in hand since the founding by the British of the College of Fort William in Calcutta in 1800. This afternoon, I'd like to first give you at least a general sense of the huge changes that Said's challenge has brought to the study of South Asian religions. And again, most of my examples will focus predominantly on Hindu topics, a series of changes that I often think of as a vast pendulum swinging far to one side, then to another, and finally resting somewhere very uneasily in the middle. It's in the middle, of course, that I think we live today, and I'd like to spend the bulk of my time describing where I think the study of South Asian religions is right now and what its best prospects for the future might be. The chronology of big, abstractly imagined pendulum swings is, of course, a blunt instrument, less than precise. Each movement that I'll be describing and to which I'll assign more or less a decade echoes down to the present day. And several important related movements and offshoots are elided entirely in the interest of time. I should also perhaps confess upfront and directly that, as Kathleen noted, I'm a historian of religions working in South India in Tamil, Kannada, and Sanskrit, and that the 13th century begins to seem a whole lot too modern for me. I can't help that, but it does inevitably shape my view of the entire field, so please keep that in mind when we come to the question and answer. Said's Orientalism generated a true sense of crisis in the study of South Asian religions, of questioning all categories of analysis, questioning what counts as a resource for legitimate study, questioning one's own position in the field. But it is important to note that South Asian studies was ready in many ways to hear the Said clarion call to reflect on its fields and objects of study in relationship to the processes and politics of knowledge construction. Already by the mid-1960s, there were changes afoot in the study of India and its many religions, signaled in multiple ways by Louis Dumont himself. Dumont begins his examination of caste, for example, by cautioning his reader. He says, quote, "We are in danger of projecting our own prejudices onto the phenomenon we are studying, and we require a method based on our relationship to it," end quote. The famed anthropologist of South Asia at the University of Chicago, Milton Singer, in 1966 noted that, quote, "the reading of Indian history itself vis-a-vis European history is not likely to find approval from scholars of Indian social and cultural history," end quote. The celebrated scholar of Vedic religion, an ancient Indian practice, Jarn Heestermann, notes as early as 1963 that changing scholarly attitudes toward India have precious little to do with India itself. He says, "The land which the Romantics visualized as the home of philosophers and sages is now predominantly considered as a backwater area, whatever its potentialities. It seems obvious that the reason for these changing viewpoints about India lies with the subject, rather than with the object of observation," end quote. That same year, and gesturing in yet another yet not unrelated future direction, the respected Vedicist Fritz Stahl, in reviewing an emergent theory of Sanskritization among lower caste groups, gestures toward the potential productivity, as yet unrealized in his mind, of more textualist anthropologist collaboration. He says, "Classical Indologists tend to look upon Indian anthropologists as mainly interested in almost inaccessible hill tribes, in village superstition, and sometimes in contemporary affairs. Anthropologists who study India, on the other hand, are often inclined to view classical Indologists as busy with case endings and etymological derivations, or as discussing obscure and long-forgotten doctrines. Yet neither field has been able to dispense with concepts traditionally handled by the other. And he goes on to outline ways in which he hopes this impasse might come to be relieved. Now, I'm not at all sure that the anthropologist-textualist divide has been healed. Maybe Kathleen and I can debate this in the Q&A. But here's Stahl, who spent a great deal of his career studying the living Vedic ritual traditions that survive among communities of Brahmins in southwestern India, suggests that both acknowledge more overtly common areas of inquiry, common assumptions, and common methodologies. Yet Said's account of the construction of colonial knowledge as the handmaiden of imperialist policies propelled such early tendencies toward post-positional self-awareness, questioning the imposition of categories, and the general politics of knowing in dramatically new directions. In the decade or more following Orientalism, again first published in 1978, the study of South Asian religions swung radically in the direction of deconstruction. And since I'll be voting for Bernie Sanders in the Massachusetts presidential primary, let's call this a sharp swing to the left. That's your left, right? Over that way. All categories, from Hinduism and Buddhism to the very idea of India itself, were pointedly shown to be, following Said's lead, the pernicious products of the European colonial assumption and impulse. This was the era of my undergraduate and earliest graduate training, and the basic lesson was very clear. All colonial knowledge was suspect. Whatever we thought we understood about religion in India, whether from colonial era scholars, from missionaries, from early European readings of Sanskrit texts, and anything we thought we understood from post-colonial thinking built on these shaky foundations could simply no longer be trusted. I think we also began to not trust anybody who was gray-haired who was teaching us. Book after book, article after article emerged throughout the 1980s and well into the 1990s with titles trumpeting these critical aims. These are real titles. The Invention of Caste, Sri Lanka, The Invention of Enmity, Naming Hinduism, Rethinking Hinduism, Hinduism Revisited, Hinduism and the World Religion Fallacy, Orientalism and the Modern Myth of Hinduism, Orientalism in the Postcolonial Predicament, Perspectives on South Asia, and, of course, the many imagining Indias that came out. Among the most widely read and discussed of the many imagining Indias that were published during this period was the one written by Ronald Inden of the University of Chicago. Inden begins his masterful study of the powerful ways in which the attribution of essences to Indian civilization by 19th and early 20th century European thinkers utterly strips all Indian agents of their basic human agency. He opens the book, and I quote, "In this book, I criticize the knowledge of other that Europeans and Americans have created during the periods of their world ascendancy. The specific object of my critique is the Indological branch of Orientalist discourse and the accounts of India that it has produced since the Enlightenment, but it also takes on the other disciplines that have had a major part in making these constructs of India, the history of religions, anthropology, economics, and political philosophy. I wish to make possible studies of ancient India that would restore the agency that those histories have stripped from both its people and its institutions," end quote. Inden's work and others like it, all looming very large in my own training as a graduate student, ushered in a period, one in which I would argue we still live, of questioning every category that does not emerge straightforwardly from our texts, our fieldwork, or other materials, of questioning whether religion itself is a proper South Asian field, and if so, where it begins and ends. The basic South Asian resources used by colonial scholars, Brahmin pundits or learned teachers in their Sanskrit texts, also grew increasingly suspect as more and more doctoral programs in South Asian religions expected training not only in classical Sanskrit, but also in at least one modern vernacular language. As early as 1958, the National Defense Education Act, passed by Congress in response to the Soviet launching of Sputnik, centers for the study of South Asia began to appear at research universities across the country. By the 1980s, now supported by Title VI of the Higher Education Act of 1965, full national resource centers focused on South Asia were making possible an ever-increasing array of instruction in modern South Asian languages, literatures, histories, and religious cultures. I was thrilled to discover in early 1990, for example, that there were two extant Buddhist texts composed in Tamil, a South Asian language that I was just beginning to learn, and that these two texts fit no operative categories of Buddhism. This was a perfect dissertation in the early 1990s. Amid this post-Said concern with category construction and imposition in the late 1970s through the 1980s and beyond, one can also readily detect, at least in Hindu studies, multiple shifts in styles of presentation. Gone, of course, are the confident Dumontian comparisons of two distinct civilizations. Instead, textualists and anthropologists alike begin to introduce their works through positioning themselves in their respected fields, explaining how they came to have an interest in South Asia or religion more generally, and expressing, often at great length, the perceived limits of the coming study. Ann Gold's first book, Fruitful Journeys, The Ways of Rajasthani Pilgrims, came to epitomize this concern for me simply because of when I first read it. It was the first such positioning I ever came across in my own field. On the very first page of the preface, Gold tells her reader, quote, "Intellectual viewpoint, personalities, and human relations influenced both the collection and ordering of the data. In an introductory chapter, I place this study within a number of simultaneous realities, all of which to some degree molded its methods, styles, and conclusions. Among these settings," she puts that term in scare quotes, "I include my anthropological questions as well as my emotional quirks, both having in different ways shaped the finished product. Translation styles also change dramatically. Dharma is no longer ethics or religion itself, but explained at great length upon first usage and then simply left as dharma. Caste, from the Portuguese La Casta, yields to the Sanskrit jati. Devotionalism yields to bhakti. Transliterated spellings are standardized. Diacritic use becomes commonplace to induce more accurate pronunciation, and as early generation Apple desktops make it possible without penciling in all of those pesky macrons. Every good pendulum swing to the left, of course, generates a swing back in the opposite direction, one that in the case of study of South Asian religions might be called a long swing toward a view of complex collaboration. Wait a minute," said many a South Asianist in the wake of Said. "Not all Orientalists supported the Raj, and not all English administrators portrayed Indians as effeminate weaklings." Furthermore, as much excellent work would go on amply to demonstrate, behemoths like Hinduism were forged as much by Indian intellectuals as by Europeans in ways that Said himself never initially imagined. Thus the field began to see excellent new work on the so-called Hindu reformers of the 19th century, not merely as dupes of Protestant imperialists or educational systems, but as intellectuals and agents operating with unique talents and with unique purposes in mind. Brian Hatcher, who I think spoke here last year in Vivekananda, is a great model of this mode of scholarship with his several books on Bengali Hindu reformers such as Bidyasagar as Bengalis and Hindus first and foremost. Given this new and frankly long overdue focus on Hindu intellectuals as agents in the construction or reconstruction of their own tradition, the invention of Hinduism titles of an earlier decade morphed instead into questions, epitomized perhaps by the title of David Lorenzen's 1999 article, "Who Invented Hinduism?" It's no longer a given that it's invented, it's who did it. By the late 1990s, the answers to Lorenzen's question were increasingly complex, as neither colonial nor Indian knowledge construction could be seen as seamlessly monolithic, and the processes and power dynamics of collaboration in generating categories like Hinduism, caste, or even something like Vedanta came into view in more and more detail. my now colleague and erstwhile dissertation committee member, whom I've already mentioned, Charlie Halsey, for example, in the late 1990s, pointed out in the widely cited article Roads Taken and Not Taken in the Study of Theravada Buddhism, the key differences in early British and French studies of Buddhist cultures, and noted what's been lost to Anglophone Buddhist studies in ignoring early French colonial observations in Southeast Asia. Wilhelm Hobfaus's masterful India and Europe, to my mind, still the most provocative and compelling intellectual account of the colonial encounter in India, traces intellectual movements from India to Europe, from back again, in such complex ways that Said's neat vector of influence from Europe eastward is forever disrupted in the field. Sticking perhaps to my now overwrought pendulum metaphor, in this our 21st century, the study of South Asian religion swings to my mind somewhere in the uneasy middle, where it often seems that every article and book, certainly every dissertation, opens with a positioning of the author in the field and often a very long series of definitions of terms with accompanying caveats. Very often there is some manner of claiming the limits of the study as if to forestall any critique of overgeneralization. Volumes on any aspect of Hindu thought and practice seldom open with declarative statements. Rather, they tend to pose very large questions. Kim Knott, in her Hinduism, A Very Short Introduction, published in 2000, for example, opens with this. Is Hinduism a religion like others, and what are the principal characteristics which define it? In each of the following chapters, as well as discussing a particular theme, I will raise the question of what the theme may tell us about the nature of Hinduism, the religious system of the Hindus. For example, in the next chapter, the centrality for Hinduism of a collection of religious texts known as Veda and the culture of the Brahmins, the caste of ritual specialists, will be discussed. Then, in the penultimate chapter, I will consider to what extent Hinduism can flourish outside India and whether or not someone can choose to be a Hindu. Is Hinduism a religion for all or only for those born into Hindu families? This is now quite typical of all Intro to Hinduism books. One troubling aspect of where we stand now, I would argue, is that the study of religion is, at this point, somewhat on the retreat within the larger region-based field of South Asian studies. A post-Orientalist, post-colonial assault on the study of religion, I don't think that's too strong a term, has come from two very distinct quarters in the case of South Asia. First, the work of the Subaltern Studies Collective, formed in the United Kingdom in the early 1980s, largely by Indian and British historians of the colonial period in South Asia, with its Marxist and Gramscian inflections, has, with very few exceptions, ignored religion altogether. Subaltern study deploys a language of capital and market, labor and power, and while never quite calling religion an opiate of the masses, nonetheless the subalternists provide often gripping new historical accounts of the colonial period from marginalized perspectives without even mentioning the religious lives and practices of such communities. As recently as 2011, anthropologist Kalpana Ram was able to note without any irony or exaggeration the following. Postcolonial theory has only partially enabled an engagement with subaltern popular religion. The Indian version, preoccupied with the dialectic between colonialism and nationalism, does not necessarily require actual engagement either with subalterns or with their practices in order to produce a seemingly self-sufficient account of modernity. A different set of problems is located with other influential models, such as Gayatri Spivak's critique of voice as unmediated presence. She goes on to argue how her focus on mediums in South Asia model a different kind of communication that subalternists should theorize and work with. A second assault on the study specifically of religion in South Asia has come from a very, very different corner, from the work on pre-colonial literary theory pioneered by Sheldon Pollack, currently at Columbia University, and his students. Pollack's focus on literary theory, both in Sanskrit and in the regional languages of India, in relationship to the regimes of power centered in royal courts throughout pre-modern South Asia, has modeled new and truly exciting ways of reading texts, attentive always to the political imagination that produced theoretical works on the nature of poetic literature and its formal qualities. Yet nearly all of Pollock's work eschews any focus on religion per se. While certainly medieval devotional poets often composed the first texts we have in many of South Asia's regional languages, what Pollock terms a movement of vernacularization is not, quote, the emergence of primeval and natural communities of peoples and cultures, but the historical inauguration of the naturalizations of peoples and cultures through new conceptual and discursive practices. What he terms a model of reading Sanskrit, the Sanskrit cosmopolis and vernacularization is about theorizing literary language, not actually using regional language. The locus of such theoretical naturalization is neither the temple nor the monastery for Pollock, but the royal court. Again, for all the productive ways in which Pollock's work has spurred new ways of reading pre-modern South Asian texts, we thought we understood. His dominance in the field has produced a new focus on theory, devoid of specifically religious contexts, particularly in terms of Alankara Shastra or literary theory and Nyaya or Tarka logic. Particularly in the case of the plethora of new studies emerging on Indian logic, I happen to teach at one of the epicenter of producing such works, the focus is often very comparative. Putting Sanskrit theories of logic in conversation with contemporary Euro-American analytic philosophy. With very few exceptions in both cases, the religious commitments, implicit or explicit, in theoretical or philosophical works are left aside in favor of what Hayden White, the historian, might well deem intellectual histories implotted in a comic mode, with a reconciliation of Indian and Euro-American ideas, from which Euro-American contemporaries, it is always argued at the end, should learn much. Some of the most promising work, to my mind, in the study of South Asian religions recently, and from this ill-defined position of our friendly pendulum somewhere in the middle, is that work that attempts to learn the excellent lessons of reading and interpretation from Pollock, and the most applicable lessons from subalternist historiography, without the complete elision of religious concerns. Some such work has looked more closely at the religious elements in courtly literature. Others have begun to examine more closely the religious commitments of literary theorists and the ways in which those religious commitments shape the literary and poetic theory itself. Another very promising move from this tenuous middle in recent years, again spearheaded by Pollock, but taken in directions where he himself would not go, is a new focus on the early modern, is that period that precedes, obviously, the colonial. While Said and most South Asianists in the decades since the publication of Orientalism had seen the colonial project as an utter break in South Asian history, generating a gap, one could even call it an abyss, between the modern and the traditional, this recent work draws a far more complicated picture, focusing on the ways in which pre-colonial developments in intellectual and religious cultures paved the way for what Hindu thought and practice would become by the early 19th century. Andrew Nicholson's excellent book, Unifying Hinduism, for example, shows how influential pre-colonial thinkers writing in Sanskrit long before the coming of the Europeans portrayed Vedanta philosophy as the ultimate unifier of diverse belief systems, paving the way for the work of later Hindu reformers such as Vivekananda, Radhakrishnan, and Gandhi, whose teachings promoted the notion that all world religions belong to a single spiritual unity. Jack Hawley of Columbia University, his most recent book, critiquing the popular idea of bhakti or devotion as a movement that liberated lower castes from the shackles of Brahmanism, not only shows how the bhakti movement idea appealed to the democratic impulses of colonial and post-colonial South Asian leaders, but that the movement idea had clear pre-colonial precursors in the course of Western Rajasthan. In Hawley's fascinating narrative, to quote him, India, Indians, and Indian languages turn out to be at least as important as England, Englishmen, and English in the generation, maintenance, and marketing of this major idea of cultural and religious history, end quote. In such a context, the advent of European colonial rule seems less a sharp cultural break, more an occasion for realigning older ideas with newly articulated ends. The field has moved, in short, from imagining India and the invention of Hinduism in the 1970s and 80s to who invented Hinduism in the 1990s to cite the title of Brian Pennington's 2005 monograph, Was Hinduism Invented at All? And if so, by whom and for what purposes? Was it invented, or are the many categories that we now wrangle with, worry about, and wring our hands over the complex product of intertwining strands of thought, ambition, and desire, both South Asian and Euro-American, stretching back many centuries before British and French East India trading companies first set up shop on Indian shores? If our pendulum rests in a somewhat nebulous middle today, in a place of many active agents, both South Asian and Euro-American, whose motives are often difficult to discern, with complex questions of historical cause and effect or influence often unclear, another issue keeps the tensions in that nebulous middle high, particularly in Hindu studies. A voice that no one in the 1970s anticipated, and one that has made speaking in public about anything Hindu a politically fraught matter today. In fact, even mentioning this makes me a little bit worried that this is being recorded and will be on the website. I speak, of course, of the many voices of the Hindu nationalist right. Voices that claim, in short, that no one who is not Hindu can say anything at all about Hinduism without fear of public reprimand, threat, or reprisal. Increasingly, even Hindu scholars have come under attack for speaking of Hindu topics in unapproved ways. All of the authors whose recent work I've just mentioned, Pennington, Hawley, and Nicholson in particular, have felt the vitriol, and it is vitriol, of such forces, many of them funded by the so-called Sangh Parivar, the Association of Hindu Nationalist Groups in India, including the current ruling BJP party, and by wealthy diaspora Hindus here in North America. Beyond the obviously racist overtones to such critique, the intellectual ironies abound. What counts as Hindu for such self-appointed Hindu spokesperson is almost entirely built upon those colonial Euro-American constructions of Hinduism that the academic study of religion has tried so hard to dismantle and rethink over the past five decades. Max Müller's 19th century works on Hinduism, translated into English, for example, continue to sell very well in South Asia, with regular reprints and new editions. If the Hinduism of the colonial era Euro-American observer rendered the Hindu effeminate, weak, superstitious, and idolatrous, and obviously in need of British disciplinary rule, then the Hinduism constructed on that foundation today by post-colonial nationalists is one of exclusion and political vitriol aimed at anyone and everyone who fails to toe the line. Looking forward to the next 50 years, I think that one of the most pressing issues upon the study of South Asian religions is to address, and I think it must be collectively, the Hindu nationalist or so-called Hindutva, Hinduness, challenge. The repeated bullying of academic speakers making contributions to the field by non-academics who basically object wholly on racial or political grounds has to stop, but it won't be easy. But we have to try, and try collectively, to distinguish far more clearly the academic study of South Asian religion, Hindu forms right now in particular, from the concerns of specific communities of Hindu practice, because the concerns of each are simply not the same. While certain brands of Christianity in the United States, as we all know, for example, may and do object mightily to things said about Christian history and practice in the academy, we don't seem to worry much over not inviting firebrand evangelical preachers to the annual meetings of the AAR. The political agenda of the Sangh Parivar, both in India and far closer to home, of shutting down free speech, of policing ideology, of trolling the internet looking for objectionable things said by those of different skin tones, is not our agenda in the academy, but we ignore or dismiss this challenge at our collective peril. Turning more positively to intellectual matters, one productive way forward in the field more generally, to my mind, is to perform the critical rethinking of categories done for Hindu traditions over the past 40 or 50 years for other South Asian religious traditions and communities. The critique and tentative reconstruction of what it means to be Hindu, for example, has paralleled similar trends in Buddhist studies scholarship, but it has only begun in Sikh studies and the study of South Asian forms of Islam. One of the traditions increasingly at the center of my own research, the Jains, has interestingly yet to undergo the post-Orientalist critical examination, keeping the study of Jainism, I would argue, largely in a mode of exceptionalism within the wider sphere of South Asia. Turning back to some of the important work of Pollock and his students, another very productive direction in the study of South Asian religion lies, in my mind, in continuing to think beyond the clear and at times seemingly impassable divide between political and religious institutions and practices. Translated into pre-modern South Asia, that's court, monastery, and temple, that so much of Pollock's work assumes. All genres of South Asian religious literature deserve the kind of close, philologically and historically rich readings that Pollock's work affords both ornate courtly poetry and its theorists. What precisely are the parameters, goals, and contexts for the composition and consumption of any number of genres, from Pancharatra Sanghita and Shaiva Agamas, those are ritual texts, to stotra, hymns, Gita, songs of praise, Mahatmya, other kinds of songs of praise, Tantra, Shastra, legal treatises, Padati, Bhashya, Tika, Vritti, different kinds of commentaries, and a host of narrative genres beyond the Pollock focus on Kavya. We have about 37 different genres of narrative literature in South Asian languages, and none of them have gotten this kind of attention. Such work has only just begun, and much remains to be done on virtually every genre of religious text and textual production. Pollock's careful contextualization of poetry and poetic theory in the social and political worlds of pre-modern South Asian courts provides a compelling model for how other genres and other kinds of texts beyond those he considers might reveal something of the world that produced them, despite the obvious reticence of so much of the extant textual corpus to speak directly in any way to its contemporary moment. Over three decades ago, historian Dominic Lacapra argued that even a novel documents something of the circumstances of its own production. Yet thus far, relatively few scholars in the study of South Asian religions have ventured to reimagine what might actually be documented by a Purana, a Bhashya, a Shastra of any sort. In what worlds does the composition of a Mahapurana or an Upapurana, no less vernacular Puranas adapting the form for new topics, make sense? Might a long durée study in the manner of Pollock's focus on poetry and poetic theory of any one particular religious genre perhaps serve to raise new historical questions and insights? On no topic has the easing of this courtly, political, or temple religious divide proven more productive in the last half decade than in recent studies of the great medieval literatures of bhakti, or Hindu devotionalism. Jack Hawley, who I've mentioned, Monica Horstman, and their many collaborators have begun to explore at length the late medieval and early modern North Indian Vaishnava sects in relationship to political authority. Recent work of Christian Novetsky on the Marathi-speaking Saint Namdev carefully considers specific sites of public memory of Namdev in all their religious, political, social, and aesthetic complexity. The literatures and contours of bhakti, in other words, demonstrably reveal more than the single-minded, ecstatic outpouring of holy men and women of the past. Thinking more critically about the vast literatures and practices associated with these devotional movements in all their linguistic, aesthetic, and formal variation in terms of the cultural, institutional, and political contexts that such literatures and practices both anticipate and seek to shape is beginning to provide a much more nuanced understanding of the work of any particular poet, saint, commentator, or theologian. Bhakti, as a religious orientation focused on a divine figure capable of granting liberation to his or her devotees, eventually utterly transformed the cultural and religious landscapes of South Asia across all religious communities, from the enormous temple complexes it produced in the physical landscape to the vast new bodies of literature in many genres and languages that began to emerge as early as the 7th and 8th centuries. Yet the conditions that allowed for that emergence, flourishing, transmission, and transformation of the many and various communities of bhakti in South Asia are only now just beginning to come into some kind of scholarly focus. Another fascinating avenue of research gathering up a good head of steam right now in the study of South Asian religions might be characterized as breaking down the divides not between temple and court, but between and among religious communities themselves. While the politics of contemporary South Asia draw ever more clear lines between Hindu and Muslim, Sikh and Jain, Buddhist and Christian, much promising work, much of it responding directly to the troubling political situation today, paints a much more complex picture of interreligious debate, appropriation, and mutual exchange. Much of this work is anthropological, ranging from studies by Peter Gottschalk on the complex strategies of Hindu and Muslim negotiation after the rise of the BJP, to a plethora of recent studies on shared religious spaces, such as Afsar Mohammed's examination of the diverse religious communities in southern India who celebrate the annual Muslim festival of the Peers. This work on intercommunity relations has also extended historically, expanding scholarly understanding of the complex processes that continually created and recreated identities of Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, or Sikh. Despite the claims of politicized Hinduism to the contrary in recent decades, no religious tradition ever developed in a vacuum in pre-colonial India. The medieval South Asian religious landscape was an extremely diverse one throughout, with numerous centers, court, temple, monastery, pilgrimage site, of what Richard Davis has rightly termed patterns of productive encounter. Yet the historical processes of that engagement, exchange, and adaptation among religious communities remain largely obscure, even in the contemporary moment. While the highly stylized and rhetorically rich forms of direct address and debate in philosophical texts have begun to be productively explored, other forms of constructive engagement among Buddhists and Jains, Shaivas and Vaishnavas, Brahmins and Muslims merit much closer examination. Comparative work focused on direct engagement, debate, borrowing, and adaptation in ritual theory and practice, image, institution, various genres of texts, promises to yield far more nuanced understandings of what constitutes particularly Hindu thought and practice, both intra and inter-religiously, no less the intellectual and cultural processes by which such identities were formed and continually reshaped. While I'm on a roll here, envisioning what a bright future for my own particular area of religious studies, let me also posit another way forward that is promisingly productive. This is something that, again, Milton Singer made a gesture toward earlier, way back at the beginning of the talk in 1966. And that is for the textualist and the anthropologist, the epigraphist and the art historian, the literary scholar and the performance theorist to marshal their resources for projects both historical and contemporary. Since I'm a textualist who seldom looks beyond the 12th century, please allow me to focus on the possible historical boon that this will prove to be. Although texts obviously provide one of the richest sources of evidence for any kind of human activity in pre-modern South Asia, how do texts compare, align, and/or resist the extant historical evidence of architecture and institution, image and practice, material and aesthetic culture? Leslie Orr's pioneering work, first published in 2000, on the roles and status of women in medieval South Indian temples, relying heavily on epigraphical evidence, provides substantially new context in which to read Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain religious texts from the Tamil-speaking South, as well as to chart change, both subtle and dramatic, over the course of time. Richard Davis has performed similarly groundbreaking work in exploring the lives of artistic pieces as objects both materially and discursively constructed that points toward new contexts for reading the literature of temple, monastery, and court. Crispin Branfoot and others offer the perspective of art historians on the temple complexes associated with various genres of Tamil devotional poetry and hagiography, as well as Sanskrit ritual or technical treatises. Finbar Flood demonstrates the varied ways in which material culture mediated the encounter between Hindu and Muslim elites in the medieval period. What these and other such studies demonstrate, in other words, is the possibility of examining wider patterns of concept, convention, and sensibility across not only genres of text, but across larger genres of human cultural activity. Such a broader perspective would serve to highlight the specific goals and uses of each particular kind of activity and contribute toward a deeper understanding of the milieu that produced any given artifact or text. Although more than two centuries have passed since the publication of the first Indian inscription by Sir Charles Wilkins in 1781, the estimated 90,000 inscriptions in various languages from all regions of India and ranging from the 4th century BCE to the present day, temples are still being inscribed, they remain a vital but still underdeveloped resource for furthering scholarly understanding of South Asian religious life in history. Richard Solomon's 1998 Guide to the Study of Indo-Aryan Inscriptions is invaluable. Similar assessments of the enormous South Indian inscriptional corpus and its study are urgently needed. Yet more than simply cataloging, translating, and interpreting, let's say publishing, right now the Archaeological Survey, I think, is publishing inscriptions found in the 1920s, more work remains to be done on developing historically responsible sets of reading strategies for the inscriptional record. While many scholars from Pollock to Solomon have recognized the literary aspirations of inscriptional prashasti or royal panegyric, how is one to make sense of the very fact of inscriptional evidence, the mixing of panegyric with often tedious administrative detail, the placing of the entire written unit in a darkened corner of an enormous temple complex where it might never be read, in fact, probably never was read by human eyes? What exactly is an inscription, and why were inscriptions composed and engraved on copper plates, images, and temple walls? What was their intended use? Who was their primary audience? How should one read the evidence of epigraphy alongside the other texts of the same period? Dawood Ali took a pioneering step in reading medieval South Indian copper plate prashastis alongside mythological narratives to argue that such panegyrics indicate an ongoing public conversation among competing royal courts, locating specific royal figures historically within a broader conception of world history. Such creative rethinking of epigraphical evidence as both embedded material object and participant in larger discursive practice promises to yield far greater insight into the complex relationships among polities, institutions, religious communities, and individual texts. Expanding the scope of the study of South Asian religions also, I would argue, demands thinking beyond the fixed geographical boundaries of India or South Asia. As Matthew Kapstein rightly notes in a recent essay, quote, South Asia's traditional ways of knowledge belong not to South Asia alone, end quote, but also to the many and complex varied cultures of Central, Southeast, and East Asia. Yet scholarly understanding of Hindus on the move throughout Asia in pre-modernity and into the colonial period, no less the texts and intellectual cultural practices they carried with them, lags substantially behind that of, say, pre-modern Buddhists. How might scholarly understandings of religious literature change and deepen if various genres, agama, puranas, stotras, katha, could be located in wider networks of conversation, transmission, debate, and exchange? Just as Tibetan materials so often shed light on processes of cultural production and transmission in India, how might greater understanding of Hindu thought and practice throughout medieval South and Southeast Asia, at the very least, shed light on developments in India itself? Just as the study of contemporary Hindu thought and practice necessarily includes the now global Hindu diaspora, illuminating not only Hindu communities in the diaspora, but also developments within India itself, the study of pre-modern Hindu literatures can only be enriched by examining the remnants of literary material culture beyond India proper, by interpreting any given text or artifact as potentially part of complex networks of use and exchange. Much of what I've been suggesting thus far amounts to a call to continue to rethink the extant scholarly narratives of South Asian religious life and culture, to reconceptualize their settings, whether that be court, temple, or monastery, to realign patterns of relationship across genres, across expressive media, across time, across region, to add new characters as new materials are discovered and studied, and to redraw old characters as they emerge in new light and in new contexts. Much has changed in the scholarly approach to history since Leopold von Ranke infamously declared in the mid-19th century the task of the historian to be documenting the flow of events, my German pronunciation is terrible, wie es eigentlich gewesen, as it actually happened. Yet given the paucity of historical materials for the study of pre-modern South Asia, so often any given text is the only evidence we have of human cultural activity, its provenance impossible to pinpoint with any certainty, it is often tempting indeed to read and interpret the content of Hindu literature as transparently documenting the social and cultural realities that produced it. Ritual theory and representations as actual ritual practice, images of royalty as indicative of conceptions of kingship, literary characters as mirroring the position of Brahmins or women or ascetics in human society, inscriptional dates as marking objective temporal loci, Dharma Shastra as unproblematically reflective of social organization and cold, philosophical purvapakshan or opponents as flesh and blood historical opponent in face-to-face debate. If the upheavals in the academic discipline of history over the past 50 years can teach the scholar of South Asian religion anything, the basic lesson is surely this: that all texts, no matter what their provenance, language, or genre, simultaneously reflect, create, and seek to change or influence. A given text obviously reflects something of the world in which it is produced. Medieval Hindu literature does not imagine spaceships flying to the moon, nor could Shakespeare envision Hamlet consulting Brahmins in his Danish court. Building on the range of the possible, any text also creates a coherent world unto itself, whether that world is expressed in poetic, philosophical, analytic, narrative, or imperative forms. Every text not only reflects and creates, but also seeks to shape or mold its reader, perhaps even to remake the world of the here and now. Indian literary and dramatic theory, with its focus on the affective dimensions of poetry and drama in the generation of rasa, or aestheticized emotion, makes such change the raison d'etre of literary art. Philosophical texts seek agreement with a siddhanta or final conclusion by reasoned persuasion. In the absence of corroborating evidence from extratextual sources, the task of distinguishing among the reflective, the creative, and the persuasive aspects of any text is, of course, never an easy one, and must certainly begin with close, careful reading and consideration of the world within the text itself, its horizons of possibility and anticipation, its sets of assumptions, understandings, and plausible conversation partners. Working with full realization that the 9th century Talmud Tiruvasaham is something other than a spontaneously unthoughtful devotional outpouring of the Shaiva saint Manika Vasahar, that Bana does more than simply document the life of his royal patron in his Harsha Charita, or that Shankara's philosophical account is rhetorically styled to suit the author's own ultimate conclusion, implies, of course, a letting go of von Ranke's dream, at least in terms of documenting actual events and persons. Yet what is left? What kinds of history, indeed, can one do with the vast array of South Asian texts, their provenance so often so unclear? A fully satisfying answer must await the collaborative work of many over time to come, to some new understanding of what that history supported by South Asian sources might actually look like, promising perhaps a history less of chronology, event, and personage, more of imagination, of intellect, and of practice. As someone who wallows in the obscure intellectual fields of 9th through 12th century Tamil and Sanskrit materials, allow me to close on what I think is a most hopeful prospect looking forward. You can call me naively optimistic or accuse me of Hayden White comic implotment, that you well might. The invitation to think capaciously about the parameters of South Asian religions that the last 50 years have generated must end, perhaps necessarily, with a call to integrate the study of those religions far more thoroughly into the study of the world's religion and literary heritage. Pollock has long advocated for the incorporation of pre-modern Indian Sanskrit and vernacular literary cultures into the study of world literatures, primarily the classical Mediterranean medieval European. And he has recently pointed to what he calls the need for, quote, global theory of the text in constant tension with diverging local practices as part of a fully developed disciplinary self-conception of philology, quote, end quote, at the heart of, the quote continues, a truly globalized university with a reconceived global curriculum that recovers the initiatives, theories, methods, and insights of scholars across time and across the world in making sense of texts. Ambitious. We're going to integrate India into a global philology. South Asian religious materials, to extrapolate to places Pollock himself would never travel, by analogy might provide far more than simple data for a more global understanding of religion or religious cultures. Rather, South Asian textual cultures, for example, provide theories of reading, of interpretation, of transmission and preservation that might well be taken seriously alongside those of China, Japan, Southeast Asia, and Euro-America. Beyond the scope of poetry and poetics that constitute the heart of Pollock's concern with global textual practice lie substantial bodies of material on ritual, scripture, theology, institution, architecture, iconography, performance, gender, ethics, and so on, that both provide primary source material from South Asia and theory about their respective topics. How might taking Sanskrit theory seriously as theory contribute to contemporary conversations concerning the nature of ritual practice, iconography, even religion itself? How might the institutions, texts, and practices of the Hindu temple or Jain shrine, continually and dynamically constituted and reconstituted over time, productively contribute to understandings of the institutional cultures of other religious traditions? Might the consistent focus in Sanskrit literary theory on both the priti, the pleasure, and the vyutpati, the instruction of literature, inform current Euro-American theorization of narrative and ethics? How might the Hindu focus on the quality-rich materiality of not only the body but the mind and heart contribute to contemporary discussions of human personhood? In turn, how might such conversations illumine in new ways the texts of Alankara Shastra, of Dharma, temple, and building, or Vastu? Granted, these constitute very large questions that no single scholar can answer fully, but the future prospects for the study of South Asian religions shine very brightly indeed. Thanks for your attention.
Has developed to shape in certain sorts of ways, perhaps in a pendulum-like change, the study of South Asian religions. And I waited for you to talk about sex. And when you ran off that list at the end, I thought, here it comes. But you said something like, your study, it's all good because of text, gender, ethics, you said material culture,
and so forth.
I didn't hear sex. So I wondered, especially given the fact that you talked about the difficulty now that scholars have who work on religions in South Asia, and how I'm just so aware of the sort of Wendy Doniger, David White, Jeff Kripal, all those kinds of people. Who
everybody gets
have
slammed.
Got their gun pointed at their head because they want to make certain kinds of comments about sexuality among certain important Hindu personages that the nationalist people don't like. So I don't know if you purposely left that out of your collection.
Well, it's again, it's not my interest, so
Or I just love your opinion or your assessment of what is the importance of that these days. Is that part of that new study of religion for South Asia? Does it have legs? And do you think it really does have an impact upon the kind of relationship between those nationalists and American scholars who want to study in India?
Well, I think that along with the kind of, you know, Romola Thapar recently, she's the doyenne of Indian historians. She recently gave a very provocative interview online that was very quickly taken down. But one of the things she said, do Hindu nationalists not read anything? And so I think that the attitude toward works on comments on sexuality is all bound up in this embracing of not just 19th century thinking about what Hinduism properly is. It's Vedic, it's Brahminic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also bound up in a whole kind of sense of human personhood borrowed from the Victorians. So the attitudes towards sexuality are very much, they strike me in India today among the Hindu nationalists as being positively Victorian. That nothing can be said that is not, I'm sure they're not, as the Victorians did, covering the piano legs in their parlors, but yet this idea that there is a kind of, one should be ashamed in some ways of sexuality, sexuality has nothing to do with religion. All of these ideas you can find first articulated in the early 19th century and in attitudes. You can see it most clearly, perhaps, in the British reception of Krishna worship. Mm-hmm. So the first British capital in India is in Calcutta. There are two major traditions, religious Hindu traditions in Bengal, of which Calcutta is the capital. One is worship of Kali. They say very little about that. But the other is worship of Krishna as the sexually alluring figure who gets married women out of their beds at midnight to come and cavort with the bushes, in the bushes. British observers are horrified by this. And they say they embrace the story of Ram in Hindi, another major Hindu deity, simply because it seems to like save Hinduism from this sexual effeminate business that they don't understand. This is very much the sexual mores of the Hindu nationalist regime right now, is that anything to do with human sexuality is bad. If you bring it into religion, it's sullying the religion. And that's why the people who you named, Wendy Doniger, is very interested in sexuality in the Vedas. That's taking, it's like saying, that would be like for some kind of committed Christian hearing about Jesus really got married. We've been through this. David Gordon White works on Tantra, which is all about disciplined sexual practice. And so they find this anathema to the kind of puritanical vision of Hinduism and this elite vision of Brahminical Hinduism that they have. And so I think it's all bound up. And I think it's why the comments about that relate human sexuality or divine sexuality to Hinduism get this particular amount of vitriol.
Right. I guess I get that part, but my question, just to put a little finer point on it, is do you have an opinion? I'm not trying to get you in trouble with the nationalists.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'm already in trouble if they're watching this. Yeah.
Do you have an opinion about whether people who are studying religion in South Asia should advance boldly on that front, or is this a case where there's a kind of cultural negotiation?
You're going to get me in trouble with everybody right now, because I actually think, here's what I think. Right. I actually think we don't understand what sexuality means in pre-modern South Asia, before the coming of the British. How exactly is it construed as a category, as an aspect of the human being? We make a lot of assumptions. Certainly a lot of tantric scholarship makes a lot of assumptions about its place in life. I think that needs, along with gender, there are not two genders in India. There's male, female, neither male nor female, and both male and female. There are four. And so how does that work into... what I would love to see is a really... and you could look at a variety of places for this, medical literature, literary portrayals of sexual relationships, highly theorized in poetic theory, because the evocation to the audience of the erotic is the most highly prized rasa for most literary critics in the Hindu context. I don't think there's been an investigation of that. And I think that's where I would like to see those working on pre-modern South Asia who are interested in sexuality begin. What exactly is sexuality? If we're going to assume that it's not, if we're going to go along with Foucault and say it's not a natural biological given, what is it in South Asia? That work's not been done. It's not been done. I think that's what needs to be done first. then I think, frankly, we'll have a better understanding of how it operates in Tantra. I think we'll have a better understanding of how it operates in the devotional context where Krishna is the sexually alluring, strapping young god who gets the married women out of their beds. I don't think we have a good understanding of the category itself. And I think it's much, much, much more complex than it is assumed to be. That's my sense. So that's going to get me into trouble with everybody. Yes, Logan.
So I have a question sort of piggybacking on that one, mm-hmm. and your response. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about, you know, Vidya DeHedge's book, The Body Adorned.
Yes, yeah.
Which I think it's interesting because she is, in that book, positing that there is some very different conception of beauty and of sexuality,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which is, you know, which has prevented Westerners in the past mm-hmm. from really understanding Hindu art, especially Chola.
Right, that's right. That's right. She makes a good stab at another book that makes an excellent stab at also on adornment is Dawood Ali's first book on courtly manners, right, where he's trying to draw connections between the actual physical ways of being bodily in the court and literary theorization of alankara or literary ornamentation. So that's a great point. So there have been little pieces of it. However, that kind of work does not, I don't know of a single work on Tantra, for example, that takes that kind of critical look at sexuality not as a natural biological feature, but as something constructed culturally and linguistically and materially in South Asia. I don't know anybody who takes that seriously, and I think they should. So there have been little hints of it, all of them working in South India. Yeah, that's a great point. Yes, in the back.
Thinking as I was listening to you that your talk sort of reflects a shift from where you started with Dumont
mm-hmm.
and where the kinds of theories that scholars have brought to light about literature and personhood are confronting or might confront Western theories with very different senses of what a person is
mm-hmm.
or what literature is or should be. Compared to a Potterized critique of Dumont,
mm.
which was based on a kind of logic of sameness.
That's right.
And which I distrust, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think Potter's problem is that he wants to reduce everything to the same model of personhood.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Power and exchange and gifts and commodities and so on.
That's right.
So it's not that I think, I'm sure you wouldn't say that the conversation has returned to where Dumont had it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is a kind of interesting return where the kind of difference that Dumont wanted to valorize
mm-hmm.
and then the Kimmeriot then took up with the notion of the visual,
yep.
which is linked to his
mm-hmm. yep.
notion
that's right.
of hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Still has some standing and some worth to it. So I just wanted to take a little issue with Potterai as David, you know, slinging down.
I'm just presenting a Potterai as a blad up. 20 years later, look how the field has changed.
Yeah.
On the 20th anniversary of the French publication, it's already being dissed. But I agree, and this is something else, since we've got ethicists in the room, I'll look in your direction, John. This is actually something that I think more work needs to be done. In fact, I had one outline of what I was... There are multiple ways to organize 50 years of a field in an hour. And one of them was on attitudes toward human beings. And so, you know, it's a very, very common critique from all over the post-colonial world that, you know, during the bad old... the idea of human rights as it's at least portrayed in public media around the world, and it, I'm paraphrasing badly, but essentially goes like this, that in the bad old days of colonialism, you didn't recognize that we were fully human. Now you recognize individually that we're fully human, thank you very much, but now you're saying that our societies and cultural forms don't allow us to flourish, so that it's just another brand of colonial imposition. Rightly or wrongly, I think that this is then something that should really be worked on. I had thought about organizing the entire discussion of 50 years in the field on attitudes toward the individual, the human individual, and societal, we might say, broader concerns, moral concerns, because I think you could tell the history of the field that way. And I think that there is quite a bit of work. In fact, I'm on a couple of dissertation committees right now where people are actually attending very carefully to the way the person, human person, is construed and understood in relationship to the way that dharma or ethics or anything else that they're concerned with in the broader dissertation. So I do think you're right, and I think that we always, you know, I'm always called upon at Harvard Divinity School to sort of offer the South Asian perspective on something, and often it is on the basic conception of what the human person is that I want to start undoing most of the terms of the discussion. So I think more work needs to be done on it. Some has been done, but I think much more needs to be done. It's a great point. Another one? Okay. Frankly, I've just decided to not worry about it too much, because even in the experience of going into anything, quote unquote, that looks to us like a religious institution. So a typical South Indian temple, let's take Sri Rangam, it covers 22 acres, it's huge. It has multiple prakaras, so there are walls within walls within walls. The question is, when does the temple proper begin? You're going to have all of these usually elderly women or young boys trying to get you to pay money to give you your shoes, and they'll watch them because you can't go past that gate with your shoes on. Well, you can get pretty far into the temple. When does the temple proper begin? When does it become space of a different nature? I've decided, ultimately, for South Asia, for the work that I work, I'm not sure it really matters. I don't really think, I think it's a problem with the kind of Sheldon Pollack model that we're working with right now, which is that somehow there's this court which almost seems a quasi-secular space, and that religion is some epiphenomenon over here and it doesn't really matter. When Abhinavagupta sits down to write literary theory, does it matter that he's a practicing Shaiva? Yes, I think it does, in the same way that it's been shown over and over again that a European theorist sits down to write a theory of something, and it matters that he's writing in a loosely Protestant vein in one way or another. So I think that these categories that we have at one time been so uncritically invested in, we've built institutions and fields around them, I've simply decided that I'm not going to worry about deploying them and where they begin and end, because I don't actually think it works in my own life particularly well. I grew up Catholic, like most people who study Hinduism. My colleague Frank Clooney, who's a Jesuit, we once figured out that 90% of the people in the country who study Hinduism professionally and teach it are either Catholics or ex-Catholics. But I remember thinking, like, when did church actually end for me? If it doesn't work in your own everyday human life, it probably isn't very good to foist it on somebody else. So I think that, it seems to me maybe we, and certainly if you look at the way religion's being studied in economics or political science all over the university since 9/11, they seem to really know what it is that they're studying. I actually am very comfortable with the idea. It's more like a kind of organizing mechanism more than it is something that needs to be defined, because I don't think it really can be. Yes?
Kind of piggybacking on that, since you specifically mentioned Hatcher's work, I admit that we all, I think, like that kind of accepting that nebulous definition of religion, but do you also think it's important to realize when you're using that lens and when that lens may not be appropriate? I'm thinking of Hatcher's kind of rereading of 19th century Hindu revival as less of a theological revival and more of a socio-economic movement.
Right, that's right. But again, that's through his lens, right, in the 21st or late 20th, early 21st century. And did any of those lenses mean, I think we're probably in South Asian studies pretty clear that religion wasn't a thing in pre-modern South Asia or even colonial, until the colonial period. But at the same time, was politics, was culture, was economy? I mean, these clear divisions we have for explaining human behavior, they were all they were talked about in very, very similar ways with similar vocabulary. I think that our modern contemporary vocabulary does not serve us well for working in South Asia all the way down. I think religion is just part of that. And so whether you want to think about something as an economic system, built in that, for example, is the idea that religion has nothing to do with it. Yet we know in the part of India I work in that temples and monasteries were larger economic players than royal courts were. Does that make them less religious? Why is that a concern for us? I think it's a big question. So I tend to, you know, I made fun of this early on in the talk that we don't talk about religious any, you know, it's Sri Vaishnava communities of practices, you know, adjectival and plural all the way down the line. I'm okay with that because I think it at least doesn't cast molds and categories onto things that aren't there. Yes, Kathleen.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to follow up on that with the part of the talk where you mentioned the certain groups of Hindus specifically who are critiquing European American scholars of South Asian religion. Mm-hmm. One of their major critiques, I mean, fits really well with this whole subject. I mean, on one hand, the academy is deconstructing the term religion so that it doesn't. There is no such thing as religion, and
yeah.
You know, religion is an aspect of culture, and you know, there are no divisions, so forth. But the Hindutva people are critiquing our scholarship and saying that what we're studying is not actually religion,
mm-hmm.
that what we're studying is culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, if you study caste, that's not religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you study anything, social movements or whatever, it's not religion.
Right.
The only thing that we should all be studying the Upanishads, basically, you know, as far as they're concerned.
Right.
So, but they're actually adopting, as you say, categories that came, you know, from Orientalist scholars and so on. Because I really wonder, I mean, you know, like, for example, in your work on the Buddhist texts, for
mm-hmm.
example,
mm-hmm.
I mean, where does literature stop and religion begin, or
mm-hmm.
where does, you know, how does the concept of religion factor in that? You say you don't use the word Buddhism.
I don't use the word religion much either.
Yeah. Okay. So how does religion?
Well, one of the ways, so I very much am a kind of religion and lit person.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I really work on. And one of the things that I think about, particularly in the next project I'm going to be starting in the spring, is the extent to which you've got authors, let's say, in a shared space, whether it be court, monastery, temple, courtyard, or whatever, and they have different religious commitments, which in South Asia means they eat differently, they don't intermarry, etc. They have different communities. They're elites. They know who they are. They're writing. They know who they are. To what extent, one of the things I'm asking myself in the next project about Jain literary practices, to what extent does it matter when they're writing poetic theory or a 4,000-verse, tale of something? Does it matter that they're Jain? Do those Jain commitments actually come in? I think that that's a more productive way to go about it than looking for the religious elements in what they're doing. So, for example, whether or not in my first book, whether or not this is Buddhism or religious or not, it's much more that people are writing as Buddhists. They're self-identifying as followers of the Bauda or Buddha, etc., in Tamil. They're dedicating it in the name of Avalokiteshvara to the king. So they seem to be claiming that their project is somehow Buddhist. How does that matter? In what that there doesn't matter at all in what they're doing. I think that that's a more to ask when does, it seems to me, as for us, it seems to me that people in South Asia and everywhere around the world, who, if I ask you, you know, who are you, John Kelsey, who are you? You know, in this context, you might say, well, I'm professor of such and such. If I met you on the street and I said, who are you? You might say, well, I'm a resident of Tallahassee. We all know that we identify in different ways, in different times. And I think that somehow we've, in the study of South Asian religions, we've often assumed that the religious identity is always front and foremost, or we've assumed it's negligible. That would be the Pollock camp. I think we need to keep it more fluid. How else are people identifying themselves when they sit down to write something? How else, and in what context are they identifying themselves? And how or what do religious identities actually matter? So, you know, I've spent a lot of time in a village in Tamil Nadu that's half Hindu and half Christian. And it's fascinating to me just to watch how differently people identified themselves when they were in the village, and then if they were in the next village, and then if they were in the nearest city. And then, of course, some of them have come to the United States, and it's always shifting. The only place they cared who was Hindu and who was Christian was actually in the village itself. Just to differentiate, so it's village hospitality. Christmas, the Christians host, and the Hindus are guests. And at the goddess festival in August, it's the reverse. That was the only time I ever heard anybody say, I'm Hindu, I'm Christian. So it's a religious identity, I think generally has been treated too simply. I think it's a complex player in a whole way of self-identification that we haven't really figured out all the details of. And that I think changes over time.
Well, we can continue this discussion on the way out. And thank you all very much for coming.